Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine. 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of We're All Gonna Die Radio here on the Deep State Radio Network. So glad that you could join us today. We have a bit of an incestuous inside the Beltway, inside the Federation episode this week, but I didn't want to let the opportunity to talk with my two work colleagues from the Federation of American Scientists, Hans Christensen and Matt Korda, because they've just released a new report this week on pretty much everybody's favorite subject: just how many nuclear weapons does Vladimir Putin have, and what does he plan to do with them? So let me just say welcome to Hans and Matt.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
They, of course, had no choice but to accept my invitation since we all work together. But Hans directs the Nuclear Information Project and has been here at the Federation for over 15 years. Matt Korda is a senior research fellow with the project. And I'm here to make you blush, guys. You do unbelievable work, relying on nothing but computers and books and magazines and interviews. Hans and Matt and the team here at the Nuclear Information Project basically keep track of how many nuclear weapons there are in different countries around the world, including the United States. And these are things that countries traditionally try to keep as secret as possible. And they do a really, really good job at figuring out pretty close how many weapons these countries have, not just how many weapons, but the different delivery vehicles, and some of the strategy and tactics that are behind exactly how these countries might think about using them. And Hans, I'm going to start off with you. We use this statistic all the time. How good are you at doing this, right? What's the best anecdote you have for just why you have confidence when you put out a number that you feel pretty good about what you're estimating?
Well, first of all, these numbers that we put out are estimates. I want to emphasize that because people sometimes get a little confused. They think when we put out numbers, those are the actual numbers, how you get them and all that kind of stuff. They are estimates. So in the nature of things, we don't have access to countries, you know, official documents and things like that that says what they have. It's very different from country to country. Our confidence in the different numbers for the different countries vary hugely. And obviously because some of these countries, you know, don't provide very much information. I mean, in the United States, we have an enormous amount of information about our nuclear forces and our normal, we have a tradition about transparency to some extent. And so the United States is the only country in the world that has declassified its history of the size of its nuclear weapons stockpile, going all the way back. No one else has done that. The French, the Brits might say something once in a while about, you know, it's around here, you know, or something like that. But no one has released the history of the stockpile. So how close do we get? Well, I mean, depends on the country. But the best case I can remember is when the Obama administration in 2010 decided to declassify the size of the U.S. stockpile and the history for that matter. I remember when that happened, and I was sitting in my office, and I had just submitted the draft for the next U.S. nuclear weapons nuclear notebook that we publish in the Bulletin of the Atomic Sciences. And when I just heard this thing on the radio, I giggled because my number was 13 warheads off the official secret U.S. number, right? So, and that just made me giggle because, you know, yeah, you can get access to all the information. And if you just, you know, put together the pieces, you can get pretty close. But it also made me giggle because it's like, why exactly have we kept this secret all these years? You know, if I can figure this out, some you know, NGO sitting in behind a desk, well, surely the Chinese and the Russians and whoever else can figure it out. So there's an element there. There's an element of verification. There's also some sort of reality check about, you know, silly secrecy.
Were you 13 too high or 13 too low?
I was 13 too low. I was 5,100 because you need to round off the number. And the actual number was 5,113.
See, that'll teach you to underestimate the United States.
Right? I know.
You know,
yeah.
never
there's a gap there. So, be careful.
So let people really know why you're here. So we, the United States, worry about a bunch of countries with nuclear weapons. But really, the big countries we worry about are Russia. That's been our main nuclear rival from the Soviet days. They were the second country to have nuclear weapons. We worry more about China. They're slowly or more rapidly growing their nuclear forces, but they're an order of magnitude below where the U.S. is. And obviously, we worry about North Korea. And then, of course, secretly, we worry about the French. But you and Matt and your team has just published the latest public report in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists on Russia's nuclear notebook. So, Matt, we'll turn to you in a second, but Hans, why don't you give us the top lines on what the report says in terms of how many nuclear weapons Russia has and how it's been changing?
Yes. So, what we can see, and there's a great deal of uncertainty about the Russian nuclear development, specifically on weapons categories that are not counted in treaties, you know, non-strategic shorter range weapons. But that has always been the case. So it's not like we suddenly have a grand new uncertainty here. It's more like how to deal with it. But the big headlines of that or the big conclusions from that is basically, you know, the Russians are, they put a lot of effort in modernizing their strategic nuclear forces and non-strategic nuclear forces. For the strategic forces, they're sort of, you know, maybe at around 90% done. And it's kind of, it's a strange thing because you're never done, you know, as soon as you start finishing over here, you have to start over here and things like that. But anyway, that's how they talk about it. And so we don't see a significant increase in the number of strategic forces. You know, yes, there are changes. And, you know, they replace some older systems and the newer system might have a little more capacity in terms of warhead that could load on it. But it's not something that rocks the boat, if you will. The fundamental strategic structure is pretty much stable. We were very curious about seeing what we could do with the non-strategic nuclear arsenal because there's so much discussion about it. And the biggest, you know, takeaway from the work in this round was just that these warnings about a significant increase of Russian non-strategic nuclear weapons, we can't see that yet. Yes, there's modernization going on. And of course, you know, important issues relating to stability and what have you. But so far, we do not see that significant buildup in tactical nuclear weapons.
And Matt, can you maybe dig down a little bit more into the details? Just how many weapons do we think the Russians have? How does it break down in these basic categories? And what are we seeing just in terms of numbers growing relative to the United States or shrinking? How do you sort of sum that all up?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the United States and Russia together, you know, comprise about, you know, roughly 90% of the global nuclear arsenal, right? If you were to take all the countries, add up all their arsenals together, you know, the US and Russia have thousands and thousands of nuclear warheads, right? Somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000, you know, if you sort of dig into their retired warheads as well. No other country sees a need for having anywhere close to that number of nuclear weapons in their arsenal. We're certainly seeing increases in some countries, China, you know, certainly growing. North Korea is growing, but nowhere on the level of the United States and Russia. So just to sort of put things in perspective, you know, when we talk about the Russian arsenal, this is the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. The the U.S. is not that far behind, and then you have seven more countries way, way, way lower down on the sort of totem pole there. So, you know, what we can sort of see, right, using open sources, right, Hans mentioned the types of sources that we use, satellite imagery, budgetary information when we can find it, you know, treaty information, military parades, that sort of thing. What we can see is that, you know, Russia is sort of, just like every other nuclear country, they're replacing basically every single one of their delivery systems with a newer version, right? There's this goal that, you know, they have these all these Soviet era systems, and all of those are being repurposed into modern systems. Some of those are being replaced on a less than one for one basis. So in certain categories, like for example, the ICBMs, you have certain areas where the number is actually shrinking a little bit. And then in some other areas, like the submarines, you have the number sort of growing a little bit as well. So, you know, the categories are sort of fluctuating a little bit. And, you know, if you were to sort of break it down roughly into numbers, you know, you have, you know, roughly about, our estimate for this notebook is about 1,500 nuclear warheads in terms of the tactical. And then, you know, you have the rest of it in terms of the sort of the strategic, with some of that being deployed and then a portion of that being in reserve as well. So that's sort of how it breaks.
But what is that? I mean, what's the total? Like, how many nuclear weapons do you guys estimate Russia has altogether?
So for this notebook, the number is approximately 4,380 warheads in the military stockpile. And that's a very small decrease from the previous year. But that's, you know, partially because of a change in estimate assigned to non-strategic nuclear forces, as Hans mentioned.
Right. Okay. And I've heard you guys talk about the office because, you know, unlike everybody else, we hang out at the office and talk nuclear weapons like all the time. It's and it's actually, well, I want to make it sound great, but, you know, sometimes it's a little depressing. But, you know, it is interesting because if you listen to the debate in Washington, you hear people saying, look, Russia is weak. Their conventional military is the second best in Ukraine. and they're going to increasingly rely on their nuclear weapons. And we've seen that in terms of rhetoric. But what you guys are coming up with is basically we're not seeing really major changes in numbers. And so I guess the question is, you know, is it just that the nuclear weapons, the investments, because there's clearly a lot of money going into it, is it just they're just getting better? Like the quality is going up? Is it just, you know, these things are getting older and it's just going to be one for one? I mean, let's put it a different way. Compared to, say, 10 years ago, do you think the Russian nuclear arsenal is more dangerous, more capable than today? Or you know, how do you categorize what we're seeing out of Russia? Because I think, you know, there's a big debate, obviously, about China, that they're growing, they're, you know, increasingly capable, increasingly want to challenge us. Putin's rhetoric has clearly gotten more visceral and more dangerous. But are we seeing real changes in the capabilities of their arsenal?
We're seeing some changes, yes. I mean, it's not a question of, wow, here's that silver bullet weapon or something like that. It's not at that level. Every nuclear weapon state, when they go through their modernization programs, never roll out nuclear weapons that are just, you know, copies of the ones they had. In all major programs, they will try to enhance the weapon in various forms. That might be accuracy, range, flexibility, whatever, depending. But I think it's important to remember here that nuclear weapons issues, especially with large nuclear weapon states that have been in the business for many decades, actually takes quite some time to change. There's a lot of sort of stiffness in the system. You know, it's structured in a certain way. There are certain traditions in the military strategy and thinking, you know, that they influence how quick you can change. So what you tend to get is sort of, you know, more or better versions of what you have. So in the case of the Russians, I would say sort of, if I had to mention one thing in particular, is in the category of the non-strategic weapons, is this sort of long-range cruise missiles, the Caliber cruise missiles that has been put into the Navy, because it comes from a family of cruise missiles that can both go in the Navy, but if you really want one, you can very quickly build one that can go on land, and apparently there's a version of them on land that violated the INF treaty. But again, it's not something that's going to rock the boat because they can't reach targets that are not already held at risk with other weapons. So if anything, you can get lost in the nuances about how you're going to use this or whatever. And then there's this big problem, and this is the big temptation, a big risk about assessing nuclear capabilities. And this is that, especially with short-range tactical nuclear weapons, in the case of Russia, they're almost all dual capable. So you will have coming out of the shipyards and out of the aircraft factories, planes or ships that can carry dual capable systems that have the option to deliver nuclear weapons.
So, Hans, explain that for a second. When you say dual capable, I'm not sure everybody will understand what you mean by that. So lay it out.
Yeah, so you if you have a missile that's dual capable, a cruise missile, so you can either equip it, you can put a conventional warhead in, or you can just remove that and put a nuclear warhead in, basically. So the problem is that when you then see those platforms with dual capability coming in, there's a tendency in the simple form of force structure analysis to say, wow, they're increasing tremendously the number of non-strategic weapons. But the problem is that not all units that are dual capable are necessarily assigned a nuclear weapon, a nuclear warhead for that mission. And so you can have an increase in dual capable launchers within a category of a weapon system, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Russian nuclear strategy therefore requires more warheads, nuclear warheads, to also be assigned to that category. So it's really, really difficult to get to a realistic estimate in that sense, because we just don't have access to that deep intelligence that really is needed to be able to give that number.
So then, Matt, let me ask you, because this gets, I think, really to, I worked in this field for a long time, and the joke when I first started out was the process of counting nuclear weapons in other countries, right, is an art, not a science, which is scary because, of course, what you're trying to do is count individual items. But back in those days, we looked at, U.S. government reports about the Soviet military capability, how many units they had. This process has changed over the last 20 years extensively because you're able to use a lot of different sources. So talk to me a little bit about how you go about doing that, and particularly how you're using open source and satellite information to sort of back up the analysis that gives you confidence about the estimates here.
Yeah, absolutely. So satellite imagery is definitely, this, I don't want to call it a new field because it's, goes back many, many decades, but certainly in the past 5-10 years in particular, it has really sort of blossomed into this really, almost like birthed a completely new field of study in some ways, because just the sheer number of actors that are involved in this space, especially on the commercial side, but then when we think about the number of tools that are free to use, right, for the work that we do, right, a lot of the programs that we use are free. We are able to monitor military developments almost in real time, right? So, using a variety of different types of sensors and different tools. So, you have different types of imagery, right? Hyperspectral, where synthetic aperture radar, like all of these things that you can sort of bring to bear when you're monitoring a country, because the most important thing that you can do when you look at a country is to develop sort of a picture of what it looks like on a consistent, normal basis, because then you can see when things become abnormal, right? So you don't want to go out and into North Korea or China or something and just try to find things that look sinister, because every single building looks incredibly sinister.
Everything looks sinister when you look at North Korea, trust me.
Exactly, right? And, for good reason. But what's really important is you sort of use all these different tools, which are now freely available, to sort of develop this persistent monitoring capability. And then that lets you sort of spot when things suddenly appear out of nowhere, or things look a little different. And then you can say, you know what? This is perhaps a new design of a missile base that we're seeing, or this is a new capability, or, in the bring it to the Russian case, we've been doing a lot of watching of this story that, Russia is putting nuclear weapons in Belarus, right? So there's a lot of monitoring that goes on sort of beforehand and behind the scenes, so that when something new comes out, you can sort of point to it and say, oh, this is an abnormal capability that we're seeing, or a new type of facility. But satellite imagery, all these new actors have really sort of enabled this type of work quite a bit.
It's a great point, Matt, that you need to sort of do this over time. I think we're all, immersed in social media, and you see the risks of people who are amateurs, many of whom are well-intended, looking at a particular event and going, oh, I can see, you know, a rocket streak from this direction to that direction. Therefore, it must be the Israelis who bombed the hospital, or it must be that this is a, you know, it's not a Chinese rocket launch for satellite. It's actually a missile test, right? And in fact, unless you have spent time looking at and seeing how they operate their systems, how these systems actually operate, what the information tells you on a regular basis, right? It's not just one satellite photograph. It's persistent knowledge about how that works. Then you're able to get into the details. As usual, expertise is valuable here. And it's why I think the Federation and you guys are so valuable to not just the geek field, which I'm a member, but also just to the public debate, because there are lots of people who make estimates. Oh, you know, China must have this or Russia must have that. But unless you've been doing it for quite some time, you can end up with, it's sort of like polling. Right. If you just do a poll and you don't know how to do that and you don't understand, my favorite story is one of the first polls that came out in the telephone eras. They started to call people and ask their information. But back then, not everybody had telephones. So you were self-selecting to the people that had telephones, which was a certain strat of society. And so you just have to be cautious about it. So
I was just going to say, and another, you know, a great example of bad OSINT is QAnon. Right, like this, like what folks are doing in the sort of QAnon community is putting together these little breadcrumbs of information, you know, that appear over time that say, oh, you know, this hidden word must mean this, and you know, like there is this whole kind of process of trying to piece together information to yield a conclusion, but the conclusions are all wrong because everyone is drawing completely unfounded inferences based on a lack of good information, right? So That's sort of like the flip side of this is you can really get down some rabbit holes that can lead you in a totally wrong direction if you are doing open source investigations kind of irresponsibly or incorrectly.
Although you've just given me a great idea, which is next week, I'm going to send you guys an email that instead of doing nuclear stuff, I want you to tell me if Elvis is really alive and tell me where he is. Because, I mean, if you can track down like the latest, you know, nuclear armed cruise missile in Russia, then you should be able to find, you know, Elvis. I mean, he wears all the sequins.
Or where is Kate Middleton?
That, we're not getting it. We can debate nuclear strategy all you want. As soon as you get into the royals, like we will get so many emails and threats.
They're my royals too. So
yeah. Oh, that's true. I should be clear. Matt is Canadian, so you know he's one of them, and we have to.
I have a personal interest in knowing where they are.
I'm sure she's fine.
Our name recognition will go up tremendously. That was great.
That's true. So you can drop synthetic aperture radar and Belarus all you want, but if you don't work Elvis and Kate Middleton into the podcast, like we're not going to get listeners. Speaking of listeners, this is the point on Deep State Radio where we have to take a pause. We want to say thank you to all of our listeners who have been enjoying this discussion. They now know way more about nuclear weapons and forensics and tracking than their brothers or sisters or uncles. But for those of you that are paying members of the Deep State Radio Network, or that pay exclusively to listen to this podcast, you will join us in a minute. And we'll talk a little bit more about Russia and Putin nuclear strategy and thinking. But for those of you who aren't, we encourage you to go to deepstateradio.com. You'll get access not only to the rest of this podcast, but all of our podcasts pre and post paywall. There's a lot of fascinating stuff that David Rothkopf and the team put together. But if you're not a member, we'll say goodbye to you. And if you are a member, just stick with us and we'll be right back.